Welcome to Simoncast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. I'm John Shaw, the director of the Institute. In Simoncast, we aim to keep the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well through wide-ranging civil conversations.
Really delighted today to be joined by Samuel Friedman, who's one of the most terrific writers in nonfiction realm in the United States. He's written 10 really important books, including a new one that is out on Hubert Humphrey and the civil rights movement, tracing it back to a really important speech that he gave in 1948. Let me tell you a little bit about Sam. He is from New Jersey, attended undergrad at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, launched a career in journalism for many years, was a reporter, including for the suburban Chicago Tribune, was a reporter for the New York Times, later became a columnist for the New York Times, writing separately on religion. He had a column writing on religion for a number of years, and then also on education. As I said, he's written 10 nonfiction books, and I am going to show you, I have a number of them in my personal library, so I wanted to show you a few of them. The first one is called The Inheritance, How Three Families in America Moved from Roosevelt to Reagan. This came out some years ago and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Have another book that is terrific called Breaking the Line, the season in Black college football that transformed the sport and changed the course of civil rights. I have a book called Letters to a Young Journalist. We'll talk about this a little bit at the end. And then Sam's current book is called Into the Bright Sunshine, Young Hubert Humphrey and the Fight for Civil Rights. This is a terrific book, and we'll spend the bulk of our time talking about that. And Sam is graciously joining us from Los Angeles. He's actually in LA, where he's going to be giving a talk this evening at UCLA, but was kind enough to join us from his hotel room in LA. So Sam, good morning to you.
Good morning. It's great to be with you, John. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Well, Sam, you your career began in news. I mean, as a young boy, you were sort of a newsman. I mean, you were local newspaper, I think in eighth grade, you were editor in chief. Talk a little bit about just how you got pulled into kind of the news business, as it were.
Right. Well, my mother was a frustrated, would have been, journalist. She was a brilliant student in high school, valedictorian of her high school, and ardently wanted to go into journalism. But because her family was in such economic distress during the Great Depression, she, as the eldest of three kids, had to pretty much go right to work to help shore up the family. And so instead of studying the things she wanted to study in the liberal arts in college, she actually had to give up a scholarship she'd gotten and go to night school and go in business administration, do something practical that would let her make a living. And so I think I was always aware of her, you know, tragically unfulfilled desires to be a journalist. So that was one piece of it. And both of my parents were very news oriented, very much people who followed the issues of the day, very much people who would encourage my brother and sister and me to participate in political discussions at the dinner table. And then paradoxically, when I was something like 8 or 9 years old, there was a huge newspaper strike in New York. All the daily newspapers stopped publishing for a period of months because the printers had gone out. And something about my parents' anxiety of not having their New York Times every morning made me think, gee, I should check out what this thing is that they care so much about. And I vividly remember at the point at which publication resumed, that's when I started reading the New York Times. And we also got the local daily paper in New Brunswick, New Jersey, which actually was the first newspaper on which Robert Caro, the great biographer of Robert Moses and Lyndon Johnson, worked. My first job in my life was being a newspaper delivery kid for that same home news in New Brunswick. So this was just in me from really early on. I'm sort of a boring role model because I never had to really cast about for what I wanted to do. I was fortunate enough to have that sense in me really early on.
Well, you said in your book on the Letters to Young Journalists, you're talking about your attraction to news, and you write, if you give me a choice, I will always prefer to write about someone obscure rather than someone famous. And as much as I savor the company of fellow journalists at a party or in a newsroom, I feel like I've done something wrong if I bump into any of them reporting the same story. Talk about that, the desire to kind of get off the beaten path and to find right. Stories that are not, being, covered by the pack.
Sure. Well, for one thing, my Hubert Humphrey book is sort of the exception that proves the rule because it's the first time I wrote about someone, except maybe the grambling State University football coach, Eddie Robinson, and Breaking the Line. The first time I wrote about someone who's really broadly famous, although in the Humphrey book, I also made a real effort to lift up people who no one knew about, and even people who'd written biographies about Hubert Humphrey had overlooked these really significant people in his life. So we can talk more about that later. But my view remains the same, that I love journalists. I love being around journalists. I've spent 33 years teaching future journalists at Columbia Journalism School. But in terms of my own work, being assigned something by an editor, being in a reporting group, even if it's covering something really exciting, like a political campaign or a major trial, that's just a lot less appealing to me than finding some story on my own and being able to be out there by myself doing it. There's a great line that my Columbia colleague and fellow nonfiction author Nick Lemon wrote many years ago in an essay, and he said that at any given time, 99% of the journalists are covering 1% of the news, and he wanted to be in 1% of the journalists covering the other 99%. So, what Nick wrote could also be a bit of a mission statement for me.
Well, I was going to say, I was a congressional reporter for many years, and just even now watching this drama unfold, you see, literally hundreds of reporters, hovering around the House floor, trying to, scope out the machinations of this race for speaker, which of course is very consequential. But it always raises the question, should some of them be out covering other parts of the world? Because, we have the speaker's race pretty carefully covered.
Right. I mean, I admire that work tremendously. I read an enormous amount of it, respect it greatly. But as you say, that's only one part of a larger process. Like, I'm waiting for someone to do a story about Jim Jordan's district. And what is it that he's speaking to there that has gotten him elected 8 times, even though, as John Boehner pointed out, in 16 years, he hasn't gotten a single piece of legislation passed. So what's happening that gives him his political traction? What does he deliver, if not legislatively, which is obviously not the case, then emotionally or whatever? And do people there support it? So even just to get out to home districts, to get out and talk to voters themselves is really, really important. There was someone I met through my Columbia work named Gary Abernathy, who'd been a long time, first working in statewide politics in Ohio and West Virginia, and then publishing a small town newspaper there. And because his newspaper was one of the only ones who endorsed Donald Trump in 2016, Rachel Maddow had him on her show. And then the Washington Post put him on contract to be a regular op-ed writer, which Gary stepped down from that after what's been now seven years. And I really appreciated Gary's work, even though I politically disagree with him on, virtually every single thing. But because he was someone who was writing out of Southern Ohio, out of the experience of that community and knew it well, and it was a different purchase on what was going on during the Trump era. And that was really valuable to me. And it forced me, even, as repugnant as I find the Trumpist movement, to have to wrestle with some of what Gary would write about. For instance, when he talked about there was, I can't remember if it was a battery plant, something that was in the either a big distribution plant or for shipping company like DHL or something in the supply chain system for big auto plants that was the big employer in his area, and it went out of business in somewhere in the mid-2000s, a good decade before Trump gets on the scene now as a candidate. But Gary talked about and wrote about the fact that people who had these decent jobs were then scrambling, and people were setting up candle making small businesses or taking much lower wage jobs, which they had to drive hours away. And that was something you didn't get from a lot of the political coverage. And so that's what I look for. And when I wrote The Inheritance, and thanks so much for bringing up that book, that's a book about political realignment. In this case, how did some of the same voters who were diehard New Dealers go to become diehard Reagan Republicans? And I deliberately looked for people who didn't do it because they got rich and wanted lower taxes because they're now in a high tax bracket. But I wasn't looking for famous people. I was looking for people who'd been politically active through their labor union or the environmental movement or local politics, but who had come to this evolution more as otherwise obscure people, because those are the people who cast votes.
Right. Well, let's talk about Hubert Humphrey. And as you say, most books begin with a question that the author seeks to answer. And this case was interesting because the book kind of began with a question that your wife asked of a fellow author, Julian Zelizer, who we were privileged to visit with a couple of years ago. But tell us a little bit about, he had written a book about Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society legislation. And so you and your wife went to a book launch and then pick it up from there.
Right. Well, Julian, like you, is someone who really is knowledgeable about the workings of Congress. And he'd written a book about the passage of the Great Society, the social safety net legislation that Lyndon Johnson pushed through. And my wife, who'd lived in Minneapolis for 25 years during her first marriage, being a good Minnesotan, asked Julian, what about Hubert Humphrey? And in the course of answering, Julian talked about Humphrey's civil rights speech at the 1948 Democratic Convention, which compels the Democratic Party to fully and explicitly endorse civil rights for the first time ever. And he said this is one of the great unrecognized landmarks in the civil rights saga. And I knew that already, but something about Julian saying it really made the proverbial light bulb go off. And the next day, being a good friend, I wrote to Julian and said, hey, the light bulb went off, but if you want to write this book, you know, I'd never touch it. He said, oh, no, I'm writing this book about Newt Gingrich and Jim Wright. And, you know, so go ahead. So I did. But the question that drove me in the way that you were saying, that I feel that a book has to answer a question. And actually, I should credit my longtime friend in teaching and writing, Michael Shapiro, for coming up with that phrase. The question for me was, why does a very white guy, a very white Christian guy, from a very white Christian place, devote so much of his public life to advocating for and defending the rights of Blacks and Jews? Because demographically, it's illogical that Hubert Humphrey should have made these the causes of his political lifetime. And that was really the question that drove me forward, because you start with Humphrey in this tiny little town in eastern South Dakota called Dolan, hundreds of miles from the Twin Cities, you know, even more hundreds of miles from Denver or Omaha or anything remotely like a big city. Very homogeneous place, almost all white Protestants, mostly Lutherans and Methodists, people of Northern European, British Isles, Scandinavian extraction. There's nothing predictive there that Humphrey would even have much encounter with minority groups of any kind, much less become one of their political champions. So solving that equation was the thing that really propelled my research.
And speaking of your research, I mean, this is a book that you worked on for 8+ years, you know, complicated, of course, by COVID. But I was struck by just the kind of the deep dive you did into these communities. And you mentioned South Dakota, and you give this wonderfully vivid account of South Dakota in the 1920s and 30s. And I caught myself saying, holy cow, at one point in the book, you refer to a reference book on weeds in South Dakota, as you described. Yeah. And I'm thinking, man, this is going into the primary sources. Well, talk about just your approach to just doing some really deep work in the archives to flesh out this story.
Well, I think an important thing is to know what your weaknesses are and to really overcompensate by working extra hard to address them. I mean, I'm not saying that it was easy for me to work on the elements of Black and Jewish urban history. that are in this book and to write about racism and anti-Semitism, particularly in Minneapolis in the 1940s. But that's the type of material I've worked on before. And I came in with some baselines of knowledge on it. But in this book, I had to write about a political convention in detail. That's something I'd never done in my life. And I really felt the importance of getting it right. And the other, at the other end of the book, chronologically, writing about Humphrey's childhood in the farm belt, the wheat belt of South Dakota, was far away from anything I had done. And I mentioned Robert Caro before. A lot of us who've admired his Johnson books talk about, and he himself in wonderful documentary film Turn Every Page talks about moving to the hill country of Texas for 3 years so he could understand what life was like out there before Johnson as a congressman brought rural electrification. And, you know, many devout Christians wore these bracelets, WWJD, what would Jesus do? I think I'd like a mental bracelet, WWCD, what would Caro do? And so I was very aware that I'd never written about agriculture. I'd spent a lot of time in the Midwest, but mostly in big cities or college towns, Chicago, Madison, Minneapolis, that I had to work extra hard to understand what life was like in that agriculture belt. And so I put a lot of additional effort into making sure I became conversant, because, you know, I grew up in New Jersey. I grew up, you know, with chemical plants and strip malls and sub shops and diners. And I had to get to know what wheat diseases were like, what predatory animals that would eat crops were like. How is the economy of a farm family structured? And I think I was always aware, because I was ignorant of those things, that I had to learn it so well that people who knew that stuff up and down and sideways would believe that I'd gotten it right. And so I literally, I don't know how many agronomists I talked to for how many hours just about this fungal disease called stem rust that was devastating to wheat crops in the 1920s and really until they got hybrids that resisted it. I don't know how many people I talked to about the process of building a gravel road, because the construction of a gravel road in Humphrey's small town, part of the work being done by a Black-owned company from Omaha, was the first time he'd met Black people in his life. So things like that, which were far, far afield from my own existing body of knowledge, were the things that I was extra sure to put extra effort into.
Right. And you also do a really important and interesting and deep dive on Hubert Humphrey's family relationships. And the one that, you know, just talk about complexity, his relationship with his father, who was a kind of a dreamer and, you know, wonderful aspirations, but was a pretty hard, pretty amazing expectations on his son, sort of like, you know, his son would kind of come and run the pharmacy so he could go out and do his politics. Talk a little bit about Hubert Humphrey's, his father.
Yeah, thanks for asking that. So his father, who everyone called H.H., is, as you said, an incredibly complicated person. And, you know, part of the process of writing biography is this triangulation. You read your subject's own account of his or her life, you do your own research, and then you look at the connects or the dissonances between those two accounts and try to figure out where the defensible truth resides. And Hubert Humphrey wrote only adoringly about his father. He never had a bad word to say about his father. And as a result, a lot of biographers picked up uncritically that vision of H.H. And part of H.H. was admirable. He was a real independent thinker. He was a liberal Democrat in a town full of conservative Republicans. He was unapologetically agnostic in a town full of people who went to church either because they did believe, you know, in a divine being or because it was socially what one was expected to do. And he imbued Hubert with a lot of those attitudes. The reason Hubert Humphrey, as a kid of 11 years old, goes to introduce himself to these Black road workers is because H.H. had told him in this famous phrase, you know, if you treat people like dogs, expect to get bitten, meaning you should be open to anybody, which was not the message of a town like Dolan, South Dakota, otherwise. But H.H. had a bit of, if you know, the Harold Hill, the con man from the musical The Music Man, he had a bunch of Harold Hill in him. He sold patent medicines that were completely fraudulent. He had these absurd, dreamy schemes of, for instance, he loved the opera, so he'd get all these opera records shipped out to his drugstore and then take them by truck out to these farmers who were struggling with falling crop prices as it was and couldn't support their families. And H.H. thought these people were going to buy an Enrico Caruso record. So those decisions put his family into even greater economic peril than they would have been in anyway. And then he's a dominating father. H.H. wanted to be the guy. H.H., you know, had a little bit of success at the very local level of politics, but had these grandiose dreams of being governor of South Dakota someday. And his attitude is that Hubert Humphrey should be subordinated to him. And Hubert Humphrey, in fact, was loyal to a fault, and I think would have ended up being crushed by his father's own ambitions had it not been for Hubert Humphrey's girlfriend in his early 20s, later his wife, Muriel Buck, who becomes Muriel Humphrey, because Muriel has a much clearer sense of the yin and yang of H.H. And Muriel is the one who, when Hubert, you know, says to her, I know this sounds crazy, but I want to go to Congress. I want to have a life of public service. She says to him, you know, I share your dream, but if you want that dream, you're going to have to leave your father. He can get another pharmacist. But if you stay here, you'll never go anywhere but Huron, South Dakota. So all of that is this really, I think, wonderfully complicated relationship between Hubert and his father. And I will say that once Hubert's star starts to ascend, then H.H. finally accepts the fact that he is not going to be the star. Hubert's the star. And he actually is a source of very good advice to Hubert politically, particularly during the turmoil of the 1948 convention and the civil rights debate there. H.H. was there actually as a delegate from South Dakota. So there's a kind of reconciliation there and a change of the power dynamic between father and son. But it's totally more complicated and endlessly more fascinating than this purely worshipful portrait that Hubert himself had written.
And you also point out that another incredibly important influence in his life was his sister, Frances, who moved to the suburban D.C. area and, you know, provided kind of an example of what it was like to break away from the family. And then in a critical moment, I think it was in 1935, Humphrey visited her in D.C. Right. And, you know, spent, you know, a big chunk of his trip sitting in the Senate press gallery or Senate public gallery watching, you know, the Senate debate. I think it was a railroad pension bill or something. And he was just utterly transfixed by, yes, by Washington.
Well, I'm glad you bring up Frances. Frances is chronologically a younger sister, but influentially an older sister. And by the way, if anyone watching this webinar is looking for a biography to do, I think there's an amazing biography waiting to be done on Frances Humphrey. And there are voluminous primary source papers, by the way. But Frances, when the Depression hits and Humphrey family has already had to pull up stakes from their initial home in Dolan, they've lost their home, they've lost their store, they move 40 miles away to another town, Huron, to try to start over. Then the things get even worse, and H.H. calls home his two sons, Robert and Hubert, because they can't afford to keep them in college. Frances is in her first year at a local college in Huron, and she's like, well, if they're having the boys come home, they're sure not going to let the girls stay in college. So she gets what money she has together, goes to Washington, D.C., where an uncle who works for the U.S. Agriculture Department lives, and puts herself through George Washington University on her own, gets a degree in social work, and gets discovered by Eleanor Roosevelt. And so she gets involved in civil rights work through Eleanor Roosevelt even before Hubert Humphrey does. And I think in some ways she's one of the early people to start talking to Hubert in the letters they're often exchanging about civil rights issues. She's doing that in the mid-30s, the late 30s. And as you said, also because she's living in Washington. In 1935, Hubert Humphrey, who's a scoutmaster in Huron, South Dakota, is planning to take his troop to what's going to be the first National Scout Jamboree, which will be held in D.C. But there's an outbreak of polio that summer, so they cancel the jamboree. And Hubert Humphrey decides, well, I'm going to go anyway, and I'll visit my sister. And as you were saying, John, on that trip, they go to the Smithsonian, they go to the monuments, they sit in Congress. He bumps into Huey Long and, you know, in the hallways of the Capitol. And it just sets Humphrey on fire. This is when he's writing these letters twice a day to Muriel about everything exciting that's happening and about this vision of a future in political life that's now been kindled in him. And just to finish up with Frances, she did extremely important work on social work in several cities during the wartime, following her husband around his military posts. He was a military doctor. And she ends up being this really significant person in this kind of Washington, D.C. nexus, which I know you're familiar with firsthand, of sort of social life and political life, in which people who may not have elective office, as she didn't, are important in getting people together, in shaping influence, in connecting people. And honestly, in a different generation, Frances Humphrey would have been a senator herself, I have no doubt about it. But in that somewhat gendered way, affected, you know, by the sexism of that era, what she was able to do was play this really important back channel role in which everyone who really knew Washington politics knew how important she was. But if you asked a lot of people who she was, at best, they say, oh, isn't that Hubert Humphrey's, you know, little sister?
Right. Well, let's talk about Humphrey's political career, because he's twists and turns, but he's in Minneapolis. 1943, he runs this totally long shot candidacy for mayor, loses narrowly, is elected 2 years later, and he runs on what we would call a progressive campaign, puts racial discrimination front and center, puts employment discrimination front and center, and then launches this administration that focuses on those two issues. And talk a little bit about that broadly, but then also the two kind of pieces of that was this self-survey for Minneapolis mm-hmm. that he launched, and also the Human Rights Council that became a critical entity in right. Minneapolis, and also kind of a model for what Harry Truman embraced at the national level. Yeah,
sure. I want to unpack all that, and I just need to proceed it to explain why Humphrey ended up being so committed to these issues of civil rights and human rights. And it really has an enormous amount to do with 1 year he spends in graduate school at Louisiana State, the 1939-1940 academic year, because he goes there as a standard issue New Deal who, you know, venerates Franklin Roosevelt and sees politics, or, you know, liberal politics, as being all about addressing issues of economic inequality, which of course are hugely important issues. But Humphrey had never had any awareness of issues that had to do with discrimination prior to that. And so his year in Baton Rouge, he lives in and around a Black community in a Jim Crow society for the first time. Interestingly, he makes Jewish friends for the first time. And to tie it all together, he studies for that whole year with an exiled anti-Nazi, part Jewish professor named Rudolf Eberle, who talks about the parallels between the Nazi treatment of Jews in Germany and the treatment of Blacks in the Jim Crow South. And all of that gives Humphrey a sensitization to issues of racism and anti-Semitism, as well as an interventionist attitude towards World War II that's very at odds with the isolationism of both the left and the right at that time in this country. And Humphrey brings that new vision to Minneapolis when he comes there in 1940, supposedly to work on his PhD at the University of Minnesota, but really to go into public life almost immediately. And when he first runs for mayor in 1943, he's running as, again, kind of a standard liberal candidate. He's running as the candidate of organized labor. He's talking about, you know, cracking down on crime downtown. He's emphasizing in this overwhelmingly Scandinavian city his own Norwegian heritage on his mother's side. But 1945, he runs a very different and bolder campaign. He's running explicitly as a candidate ready to take on what's been this long entrenched pattern of bigotry in Minneapolis. And even though Blacks and Jews make up maybe 3% of the city's population, and if you add in Catholics, who were themselves the object of great prejudice in Minneapolis, that brings up to maybe 15, 18%. So demographically, Humphrey's candidacy made no sense. But there is this moment as the war is ending, as the revelations of the Holocaust are showing up on newsreels, in articles written by American reporters, as GIs are coming home to their families in Minneapolis or to study on the GI Bill at the University of Minnesota. There is this kind of sense of this is the time to take on America's unfinished business of intolerance, having waged an epic war to defeat it in its Japanese, Italian, and German iterations. And with the mandate that Humphrey gets, as you said, John, he takes on a two-pronged approach. He wants to change laws, and he also wants to change attitudes. He wants to change laws by pushing for one of the most hard-hitting laws against employment discrimination in the country, a law that predates the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission that he and Johnson will create 20 years later. He's pushing towards a law to outlaw restrictive covenants in housing that is language in either neighborhood associations or individual D's saying you can't sell to Jews, Blacks, Indigenous, and so forth. But he knows that changing laws is only part of it. So first of all, Minneapolis has what's called a weak mayor system, meaning the city council basically has all the power. They control the budget. The mayor can't do much of consequence besides appoint the police chief. And the city council isn't particularly interested in moving forward on the civil rights program. And I should also add that also included police reform. Humphrey wanted to send the whole police force back then, decades before George Floyd's murder, for training in human relations, as they called it then. So to try to circumvent this do-nothing council, Humphrey cobbles together a little money and creates a voluntary human relations council. And in his great coalition building way, brings in people from labor, from management, Christians, Jews, Blacks, whites, men, women, people who are on opposite sides of a variety of other issues, but who all agree there needs to be progress on civil and human rights. And he uses that commission to help build up public pressure on the council to do something. And it's kind of amazing because the whole time this Human Relations Council is working, they're running out of money. The head of it goes months without being paid. And Humphrey is constantly scrambling to get donations to keep it going, but he somehow does. And the other element that you mentioned is a survey. Minneapolis had had warnings from both within the city, from Jews and Blacks, and from journalists and scholars outside for decades that it had a problem with racism and a problem with anti-Semitism. And the mainstream response in Minneapolis was sort of toss it off, say, oh, that's just like a few of the great unwashed, you know, that's not typical of our good city, all of which was totally wrong. It was typical. And Humphrey brings in a Black sociology professor from Fisk, the great HBCU in Nashville, named Charles Johnson, to oversee a study that uses volunteers to basically go around and build what we would now call a database based on opinion surveys to show incontrovertibly what a big problem Minneapolis has. And again, for Humphrey, this is also leverage. And I just want to say that even though he's a popular mayor, there's a tremendous amount of risk involved in what he's doing. And he is almost assassinated as a result of it in the midst of moving forward on this legislation. And after a period when there had been a lot of hate mail sent to Humphrey and members of his commission and his wife, and when there had been at least one other credible death threat that the police force intercepted, one night in early 1947, Humphrey's coming home from, you know, his night on the rubber chicken circuit and, you know, working the key in the lock of his door, and three bullets whizz by his head. And luckily, his family's pet dog had barked right about the time the shooter was shooting, which is probably what threw off the concentration and led the bullets to miss Humphrey. But that's how serious the opposition was. And the incredible thing about Humphrey is that almost losing his life does zero to dissuade him. He just keeps moving forward. In fact, he makes a big effort to keep even the news of this shooting out of the papers for 6 weeks, something that would be impossible now, but he was able to do it then.
Well, and Sam, I was also interested in that as his stature is rising both in Minneapolis and nationally, he becomes a kind of a national figure. And I was smiling because I read one reference you're talking about as evidence of this rising profile. He becomes chairman of the National Committee for Fair Play in Bowling. And this entity, challenged the segregated tournaments, I guess, under the American Bowling Congress. And we sort of forget that. I mean, bowling back at that time was, I think, the fastest growing recreational sport in the United States. And it was, in some sense, kind of an emblem or at least an example of our still segregated country.
Oh, absolutely. I was fascinated to find that material in the archives. But it makes sense because if you think in this period, roughly 1946, 47, 48, you have Jackie Robinson and then followed by, Larry Doby and Roy Campanella desegregating Major League Baseball. You have Tank Younger reintegrating pro football, which had been integrated early on and then banished Black players and coaches from it, but they're reintegrating pro football. And bowling, as you said, was hugely popular in post-war America, and the organization that had a monopoly over the tournaments, the American Bowling Congress, was officially segregated. And so bowling, similar to MLB, became this battleground for desegregation. And this Fair Play in Bowling Committee was like a who's who of the civil rights movement of that time. You had A. Philip Randolph, the great Black labor leader. You had Walter White from the NAACP. You had Walter Reuther, president of the United Auto Workers, and, like Humphrey, one of the most important white allies in the civil rights struggle. And in particular, Reuther and the UAW, which, had a very integrated labor union rank and file, they had a lot of their own bowling leagues. Bowling was part of sort of building fellowship in their union, among their union brethren. And so the fact that these bowling teams from the UAW couldn't compete in national tournaments was kind of a direct reason to take on the segregation of the sport. And it just kind of gets across that there was this multi-front battle in this period of the mid-40s. I place it basically 43 to about 48 is this incredible surge of civil rights activity in all kinds of aspects of life. And that includes activity against anti-Semitism and against anti-Catholic feeling as well. In addition to this realm of sports that we were talking about, there's a whole fascinating body of pop culture that's coming out then, which is giving the same message to the country. Like the Superman radio series does a storyline called Superman versus the Clan of the Fiery Cross, which, as you can guess, is meant to evoke the Ku Klux Klan. And it's about this Clan of the Fiery Cross trying to kill a Chinese-American kid who is a star pitcher on a youth baseball league team because he's gotten the starting pitcher assignment over a white Christian kid. And that's giving a whole message about American inclusiveness. And Frank Sinatra, in this period, makes both a short film and an accompanying song, both called The House I Live In, which is all about this radical redefinition of what being an American is, that it's not just being a WASP or pretending to be, or being a minority who's in America at the sufferance of the WASPs. In this film, which shows a gang of kids about to beat a Jewish kid, Sinatra intercedes and he likens them to Nazis. I mean, it's fierce language. And then when he sings the song, The House I Live In, which interestingly has its lyrics written by the same man, Abel Meeropol, pen name Lewis Allen, who wrote Billie Holiday's anti-lynching anthem, Strange Fruit. In that song, there's a line that says, "All races and religions, that's America to me." That's radical stuff at that time. And it's sending out a whole alternate view of who belongs in America.
Well, let's go to 1948. It's the Democratic convention, and we have Harry Truman, who's running for election. He had stepped in when Roosevelt died in 45, lagging way behind in the polls. He has a party that is in disarray. We have the liberal wing has basically bolted part of it under Henry Wallace. Big, huge faction, the powerhouse faction, really, the Southern Democrats are restive. And Truman is trying to figure out how he wants to deal with civil rights. His instinct is to play it safe and to kind of take the Roosevelt tack of not pushing very hard. And then Hubert Humphrey says, I can't sit back and let this happen. So pick up the story from there.
Right. Well, you're totally right. When the Democrats gather in Philadelphia during the sweltering week in July 1948, it's a given that Harry Truman is going to get the nomination. Various forces in the party had hoped to dislodge him. All those efforts had failed. Everyone in the party is morose. They expect Truman will lose. So the battle at the convention has nothing to do with nomination. It has everything to do with whether the Democratic Party will finally endorse civil rights. Because as you pointed out, John, even under Franklin Roosevelt, the party had made this, I think, morally, really this devil's bargain, almost literally, with the Southern segregationist wing of the party to either write some New Deal laws like Social Security in ways that excluded most Black workers because they're in agriculture or domestic work, or to let programs like the WPA, the Civilian Conservation Corps, you know, FHA mortgages, et cetera, be administered at the state level. So in these Jim Crow states of the segregated South, New Deal programs were dealt out in a highly unequal manner. And that was all tolerated by FDR in exchange for the Southerners voting for him on Election Day and these very powerful Southern legislators in Congress moving forward FDR's New Deal legislation. And also the party platform would never say anything direct about civil rights because the Southerners had an interpretation of the Constitution that said it's the right of the state to oversee any aspects of life that aren't explicitly given to the federal government. They called the state's rights. So since the Constitution didn't say there should be racial equality, if we want to have racial inequality in our states, we can. And Harry Truman's really fascinating and complicated on civil rights because, like, very much akin to Lyndon Johnson later, he's someone from a border state, Missouri instead of Texas. He is forebears who had been in the Confederacy, who had owned enslaved people. And Truman, though, can be affected by personal experience. And when there was a series of attacks in 1946 on returning Black veterans, topped off by an Army sergeant named Isaac Woodard, whose eyes are gouged out by a Southern sheriff who finds it so objectionable that Woodard is sitting in the bus passing through the South and refusing to go to the back of it. Truman is affected by that. It really gets him. And he starts to move forward actually quite boldly on civil rights. And then he like looks at the calendar and, November in 1948 is coming. I better forget everything I just said about civil rights, even in his State of the Union address, even in a presidential address to the NAACP. So heading into the convention, he wants to do the FDR thing of appease the Southerners in exchange for their votes. So he's made it clear, I don't want civil rights language in the platform. The Southerners, the so-called Dixiecrats, have made it clear if there's word one about civil rights, we're walking out. And it's not an idle threat. They actually have reserved railroad cars in Philadelphia to take them straight to Birmingham, Alabama, to hold a Dixiecrat convention. And their goal is to win enough states in the South that neither Tom Dewey, the Republican, nor Truman win a majority in the Electoral College, which means the House of Representatives chooses the next president, which in turn means the Southern segregationist members of the South hold the pivotal votes. And then you also have heading into the convention A. Philip Randolph, who's been leading a national campaign urging Black young men to resist the draft until the American Army is desegregated. And yes, after the American Army has fought this war against racial and religious intolerance, it's still segregated itself. And the last faction here is Hubert Humphrey and these liberals who are saying segregation in a liberal party is morally impossible. It's indefensible. It's hypocritical. They're saying we're in a Cold War battle for the hearts and minds of soon to be decolonized Black and brown countries around the world. How can we say to them, you should choose Western democracy over Marxist-Leninism when Western democracy in the form of the United States accepts racial segregation? And they have just decided that they're going to flout the threat of the Southerners to leave. They're going to flout Harry Truman's stated desire that there be no language on civil rights. And it looks like it's just going to blow apart the entire party and the entire convention. And Humphrey, because of his great oratorical skills, is the one who is given the responsibility to speak to the entire convention, to try to persuade these delegates to vote for civil rights. And keep in mind, there are 1,500 delegates, including alternates. 17 are Black. Very few are women. So almost none, if any, would be, you know, Hispanic or Asian American, probably zero of each. So it's not like there is a constituency of outsider groups who can come together to support civil rights. Humphrey is having to persuade a bunch of white men to support civil rights, which adds to his uphill battle.
And we should add, I mean, at this point, Humphrey is 37, a rising star, you know, and a leading Democratic official says, if you push this hard, it's going to end your career.
Right.
But here you alluded to this earlier, at a critical point, you know, he turns to his father, who was, you know, leader of the South Dakota delegation, and says, you know, Dad, what do you think? And he said, follow your conscience, do the right thing, which is, you know, your dad rising to the occasion there, I think.
Yeah. No, that's H.H. at his very best. And another fascinating thing that happens for Humphrey from his family is this civil rights plank is important, not just to Black Americans, but its protections are going to extend also to people on the basis of religion and national origin. So Jews and Catholics are really invested in the success of this civil rights plank battle, as are the existing populations of Chinese and Japanese Americans, Mexican Americans, who at this point are the largest body of what we now call Hispanics or Latinx people. And Humphrey, during the weeks he's in Philadelphia preparing for the convention and then having the convention, is getting a series of letters from his wife Muriel about their plan after the convention to take a typical Minnesota family vacation, rent a cottage by a lake. And Muriel is writing to him and saying, I just heard that the resort we're going to has covenants that they won't rent to Jews or Blacks, etc. And I'm going to go up there and check it out. And she goes there, and literally on the morning Hubert Humphrey is supposed to give his speech in the afternoon, July 14, 1948, he gets a letter from Muriel saying, well, it's true. I confronted the owners and they said, well, we can't take Jews. And if we started taking some, then we'd have to take them all. Because none of the other resorts on this lake take them. And she says to Hubert, we can't go there for vacation. That's not our politics. That's not our values. And I can't help but think that just like H.H. saying, follow your conscience, Muriel reminding him that, as a second wave feminist would have said, the personal is the political, also has a real effect. And then the last thing to fall into place is that there are a lot of big city Democratic bosses who are not particularly liberal, although they're New Dealers, but, you know, they run machines that are all about, metaphorically, I'll give you your Thanksgiving turkey or the garbage cans for the alley or get a job in the parks department for your kid. Actually, not metaphorically, quite literally. And in exchange, you're always going to vote Democratic, and you're even going to turn a blind eye towards some of our corruption. And that's the way a lot of big city machines operated. But these big city bosses actually had to have their fingers on the pulse of their constituencies. They weren't distant people. They're very connected to lived life. And they knew, because of the Great Migration, that they had growing populations of Black voters in their cities and their states, and that the Democratic Party was not offering Black voters enough of a reason to vote Democratic. So several of these big bosses go up to Humphrey, one of them, Ed Flynn of the Bronx, literally on the podium minutes before Humphrey is going to speak, and say, we've got your back, do this, we're going to support this, because they were concerned that not only would Harry Truman lose, but that if there wasn't a big Black turnout in these northern cities and states, all the down ballot races would be lost too. So that pragmatic element comes together with the idealistic element. And then with Humphrey's oratory putting out the message, those things come together, coalesce to persuade a majority of the delegates to vote for civil rights.
Right. And Humphrey's speech, which I would encourage students to read, I mean, I'm just going to read a sentence. It says, you know, to those of you, my friends, who say we are rushing this issue of civil rights, I say to them, we are 172 years too late. And then he says, the time has arrived for the Democratic Party to get out of the shadows of states' rights and to walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights. And Sam, the point you make is that this speech in 1948 is in some sense the beginning of the modern civil rights era, which many of us have dated to, you know, Brown versus Board of Education in 54, or the Montgomery boycott in 55, 56. But your view is that this speech, not only for its rhetorical skill, but the fact that it effectively drives Southern Democrats, you know, out of the party and causes a whole new political coalition to develop, in which the Democrats can move forward on major civil rights legislation in the ensuing decades. So pick that up.
Well, I wouldn't say, and I don't argue that this is the beginning. I'd say it's a culmination of the beginning phase, that there is this amazing period of civil rights activity in the 1940s, much of it catalyzed by Black GIs with their slogan Double V, which means double victory, victory over fascism abroad and victory over Jim Crow at home. That's kind of the moral engine for the movement in the 40s. And you have leaders like A. Philip Randolph, who had, you know, gone toe-to-toe with Franklin Roosevelt, threatening a mass march on Washington and forcing Roosevelt to desegregate the federal workforce in defense plants during the war. So those efforts in the 40s had been building up. And this is a culmination of them. And it's the big breakthrough because, for instance, after the war ended, Randolph and others, including Humphrey, wanted there to be a permanent Fair Employment Practices Commission. That didn't go through. Truman was supported, but couldn't get the votes in Congress. And so the success at the 48 convention in endorsing specifically desegregating the military, outlawing lynching, outlawing the poll tax, guaranteeing personal safety to people on the basis of race, national origin, and religion. That is huge. It's a big victory. And it's a victory that comes about, and Humphrey was very aware of this, through the combination of outside pressure and inside pressure. Humphrey, in a way, is Mr. Inside, inside the convention hall, working with people who know how to count votes, working with people who know the convention rules that they have to manipulate to give Humphrey even the chance to speak. And A. Philip Randolph is Mr. Outside, literally outside the convention hall, saying Black Americans are not going to register for the draft or volunteer or go to serve if they're called up until the military is desegregated. And there was an exchange of letters and telegrams after that convention of between Humphrey and some of Randolph's top aides, each saying, we needed you. They knew they needed the other. The insiders needed the outsiders needed the insiders. And the result, as you say, is that first of all, 2 weeks after the convention, Harry Truman issues executive orders desegregating the military and desegregating the federal workforce, two gigantic steps forward in the civil rights movement. And also, again, to your point, when the Dixiecrats leave in 1948, it really begins the process of them becoming Republicans. So even though Adlai Stevenson and John F. Kennedy in different ways will try to woo them back in and placate the Southern wing again, fundamentally, they've broken with the Democratic Party, and that becomes permanent when Lyndon Johnson pushes through civil rights legislation. So the root of the racist wing of the Democratic Party becoming Goldwater, Nixon, Reagan, and Trump voters starts in 1948. And the remaking of the Democratic Party into this inclusive coalition, interracial, interfaith, is also the product of 1948. So in a lot of ways, the political landscape we look at in 2023 is the direct linear descendant of what happened in 1948.
Well, Sam, as you write near the end, I mean, there's been, you know, significant advances since 48 on civil rights, also backtracking. And I want to read a couple sentences near the end, which was extraordinarily powerful for me. You say, "So do the shadows and dust storms triumph over bright sunshine in the end." And then you write, "The national endeavor to achieve a full inclusive democracy proceeds not with inexorable advancement, but through cycles of oppression, resistance, liberation, reformation, and retaliation. Ground can be lost, but ground can also be gained, inches at a time, pardon me, and with tenacious effort, it can be held. For all his flaws and failures, Hubert Humphrey had committed his life to the grinding work of trying." So what is Hubert Humphrey's legacy then? How should we, because as you and I were talking offline, you know, Humphrey, and sadly, is to some extent a forgotten figure in American history. Maybe students, if they know about him, might associate him with being kind of a not a strong vice president or someone who lost to Richard Nixon in 68. Talk about the legacy. Why is Hubert Humphrey important in American history, and why is he important now?
Well, I think Humphrey is a model in many ways of what we need when we're in the struggle for our democracy right now. Humphrey is a combination of a clearly defined moral core. He knows what his values are, and those values around civil rights and human rights are inviolable. He combines that, though, with political acumen. He knows that you can't just tell people what the right value to have is, that you have to figure out how to make it law, how to enact it. He understood the necessity of working in tandem with mass movements. That's important for us to remember. You need, again, inside and outside. And I think what he shows us is that these battles recur, as the portion of the book that you read, and thank you for that, tries to get across. We make progress, and then there's often backlash against that progress. And so we always have to be prepared to get back into the fray again. And Hubert Humphrey got into the fray in the 1940s, when in many ways it was as difficult, if not more difficult, the obstacles he was facing at that time. And he did it with passion, and he did it with vigor, and he did it with conscience, and he also did it with joy. And sometimes people mistake the ebullience of Humphrey as just this kind of trite, you know, Midwestern corniness. But this guy had a backbone of steel. He stood up to an assassination attempt. He stood up to threats that if he gave a civil rights speech, his political career would come to an end. And so he also shows that one can engage in public life with, you know, with joy, with optimism, with enthusiasm, even against great odds, and even when on the other side of the battle are terrifying outcomes.
Right. Well, Sam, I'm going to get you to campus to talk about book writing, because that's been, you know, you have some really interesting perspectives. But I want to end on one note, which is, in your writing, you talk about, and we have students on this call, about, you know, preparing for careers, launching careers. And you talk about what you call the in praise of gradualism. And you refer to some people from Illinois, and it's a little different, but you talk about Gary Sinise and John Malkovich, who were students at Illinois State University in theater, and decided to launch their careers by going to Chicago, working in Steppenwolf Theater. And you make the broader point that, you know, they went someplace where they could launch their careers, where they could do things, they could get tangible experience and develop skills. So when they were discovered, they were ready for prime time. Talk about that for a minute or two, if you would.
Yeah, well, the analogy I was drawing, which I was familiar with from a few years, I covered the theater industry for the New York Times, is that a lot of people would come to New York and try to make it right away as an actor, and they'd end up basically supporting themselves, you know, doing wait staff or dog walking or, you know, data entry, you know, in a law firm. And they never got to actually do enough acting to get better at their craft. And the people from Steppenwolf, who had gone to this non-elite school, Illinois State, you know, and just went up to Chicago, rented a church basement, and started putting on plays and directing them and writing them. And that's how they got good. And I think the equivalent thing in journalism is don't worry about getting to a big city or onto a top-notch news organization out of the gate. Worry about being able to write and report and broadcast every day and getting better, and let the future take care of itself. I mean, and this was my experience. I started out covering four towns in central New Jersey. My next job after that was in DuPage County, Illinois, covering 30 school districts. And it was the ability to just work all the time, to go through the trial and error, to have the good fortune of running into some really great editors that allowed me to keep improving. If I had said to myself, I want to be in a New York or an LA or Chicago right away, I probably would have been batting my head against the wall, not getting jobs, and maybe even, you know, leaving journalism entirely, although that's hard for me to even, you know, contemplate that having happened. But again, do the work and let the job market take care of itself. Concentrate on getting better and let other things take care of themselves.
Final question, Sam, I hate to ask this to you, but I know you're continuing to talk actively about your book and Hubert Humphrey. You have actually a lecture tonight at UCLA. Have you thought about the next book? Are you still just very fully focused on telling the important story with Humphrey, or has your mind started to shift to the next thing?
No. I have two competing ideas for the next book, both involving jazz history. And I'm very busy with my talking about the Humphrey book and teaching at Columbia till next summer. So I think next summer, I'm going to get back into a few archives and decide which of the two books to do. And then, you know, commit the next 8 to 10 years of my life to that.
Sounds good. Well, Sam, this has been a really delightful conversation. I've really enjoyed it, as you probably can tell. And as we've said offline, I would love to invite you to Southern Illinois University. And hopefully maybe this coming spring, and talk about both the Humphrey book, your focus on civil rights, but also some of your amazing work at Columbia Journalism School, teaching, writing, book writing, et cetera. So we will have a delightful time with you here in Southern Illinois. So let's make that work.
I would love to do that. I know you've had a great journalism program for a long time. There, one of my good friends in journalism, now retired from the LA Times, Mike Anton, who grew up in Berwyn, Illinois, went to SIU and worked on the Daily Egyptian. It's where he cut his teeth. So it would be wonderful to be there in person.
Perfect. Well, we will make it happen. Thank you so much, Sam, and have safe travels on your way back from LA to home. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, John. This was a real joy. I'm so grateful to you for offering the chance.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to SimonCast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. SimonCast is produced in collaboration with WSIU Public Radio. You can find SimonCast wherever you listen to podcasts, including NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and more. Please subscribe to new episodes as soon as they're posted and tell your friends about our show. For more information, visit paulsimoninstitute.org. Thank you for listening, and thank you for keeping the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well.